Hi, my name's Ali, and this is the Rus Files Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As always, I'm joined by a guest, and today my guest is Alyssa. Hi, Alyssa. Thank you for joining me.
Hiya. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Alyssa, before we talk about the film that we're going to be watching today, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, I'm originally from Russia. I grew up in Siberia in a place called Omsk. And then I came over to England at the age of 15 to study. And it's been 20 years now and I still live in England. My background is in film studies. I've worked with film festivals as a curator and kind of coordinator, and I've done a PhD in Soviet film history, but then had a bit of a change of heart and decided to follow my passion for food. And I've started a project called Kino Vino, which is a supper club with a twist. And the twist is that there is a film screening and the dinner is inspired by the film. So people have that immersive experience of watching the film and then kind of continuing their experience of it through their taste buds. And I also wrote a cookbook about Russian food. So it's basically all things Russian to do with film and food would probably define me best.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, with the greatest respect to my many wonderful previous guests, that pretty much makes you the perfect, most ideal guest for this podcast.
Oh, great.
So, you know, expectations, you know.
Yeah, now
you know, sorry.
That's awful. I set myself up for.
Yeah. All right. So where to start? There's, you know, so many places we could take the conversation from here. I think we'll probably start then from your experience of, you know, 15 years, that's, you know, it's a good stretch. It's not like you moved here when you're five. So you've very much had, like, a Russian upbringing, but then you've spent over half your life now living here. So, yeah, how did you initially find moving to the UK at that age?
It was an interesting thing because kind of ever since I could remember myself, my family had an interest in England through literature mainly and language as well. So I had a English language tutor when I was, I don't know, five maybe. So, and you know, my first words were a mix of English and Russian.
Oh, nice.
But I mean, only, you know, like I could say fox and say, like, you know, thank you, that kind of stuff. Nothing sophisticated, but still. So I always had English as a kind of a, you know, almost second language growing up. So when the idea came for me to move here to study, I was so confident that I'll be great because I was a straight A student in English classes in Russia. But when I came here, obviously, it was a completely different ballgame. You know, just the fact that you have to actually live and study in a foreign language, it's very different.
Yeah, and teenage slang as well.
Exactly. And my school was in Kent, near a place called Gravesend. And the accents there, I literally just could not understand a word.
Nice.
So no one explained that, you know, despite being a very small country, England has so many different accents, you know,
sure.
And within London itself, let alone the whole country. So, yeah, I was completely shocked. Probably more so because I thought I would be so good and natural at it.
Yeah.
So it took me, but I mean, being 15, you know, still very young and adaptable.
Yeah. Brain is more of a language sponge the younger you are.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, and I mean, I did have the knowledge already. It was just more kind of getting used to this. Yeah, as you said, the slang, the day-to-day.
Like the activation.
Terminology.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then just kind of unlock my own, you know, because you're initially quite self-conscious and you know, just stuck with it. Well, you know, that language is still kind of not natural.
Yeah, and I mean, one tends to be self-conscious as an adult, but as a teenager, I mean, it's weird.
Teenagers
kind of like walk this strange line where some of the time they're completely oblivious and not very self-aware at all, and other times incredibly self-conscious. It's this kind of weird duality.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's cool that we're talking a little bit about teenagers and stuff, as that's going to be the subject of the film, but I don't want to go there quite yet. About making the transition then, so we're jumping forward a few years, from doing the film PhD into doing the film-themed supper club. How did that come about?
Well, initially, my PhD was quite a tough thing to do, partly because I don't think I was ready.
I don't think I've met anyone who's done a PhD who's just gone like, oh yeah, it's a walk in the park.
It was easy. Yeah. It was a tough experience. And then my subject as well, it was about the Holocaust film in Soviet film, you know, so Holocaust representations of the Holocaust in Soviet film. So that wasn't particularly fun, you know. Comedy at least, or something, you know, family films, or I don't know. So the subject itself was quite hardcore.
Yeah, so an inherently tough process added to extremely grueling material. Goodness me.
Yes.
I'm tempted to say, like, what possessed you to choose that as the subject? But
partly family history, because I come from a family of Holocaust survivors.
And gotcha. Right.
Kind of haunting and inspiring me in so many ways. So I guess that's probably the main reason why I chose that subject. While I was doing the PhD, I felt that cooking is a really lovely outlet. Just kind of switching my head off and working with my hands, and then it's quite a lovely social thing to invite friends over for dinner. In a funny way, the food passion really started to come together, or kind of really came about, when I was doing the PhD on the subject that's, you know, could not be further from food if I tried. And gradually, kind of the more I did the food stuff, just cooking and having friends around, and I started my food Instagram. And I think it was also at the time when the whole food Instagram trend really picked up. And I saw that, there was a really great way of just tapping into this new community, which you wouldn't have otherwise had the chance to.
Sure.
And just seeing what people do with, you know, where they take their passion for food. And it's not necessarily that you just have to train as a chef and work in a restaurant, that there's so many options. That just, you know, inspired me. And then I thought, well, I still love film, and, you know, I've spent so many years studying film that it would be a shame to just leave that side of me behind and start something new entirely. So I thought maybe I can find a way to mix the two somehow. And there it was, the idea to pair film and food.
Yeah, and lo and behold, yeah, you found a way of incorporating the two passions. And it sounds like, growing up, from things you've said and written elsewhere, that food was very much a thing growing up. I mean, obviously, you know, food is a big part of everybody's life, but,
yes,
you know, the level to which it's just you have to do this for survival versus, you know, you actually get a kick out of doing it. It seems like your family was more in that second category.
Definitely. It's interesting, again, coming back to the Holocaust, that my great-grandmother, who was the Holocaust survivor in our family, she worked as a cook her whole life, so she cooked for a living. I mean, calling her a chef is a bit too fancy, because she only worked in, like, Soviet canteens and things. She never actually cooked at a restaurant, but she was this figure that inspired so many kind of interests and professional aspirations in me, I suppose. So having her cook for me and for my mom, she was a real kind of nurturing spirit in our family. And her cooking was very simple, you know, back in the Soviet days, unless you come from a very privileged family, you didn't really have access to fancy ingredients. So what we had was super basic, but, you know, it's just how she presented it. And I guess just the energy with which you cook is quite important as well. So she had the most, you know, warm and nurturing energy about her. And the food was always such a lovely, you know, moment to celebrate and get together. So, yeah, I have the most lovely food memories growing up, even though it was the Soviet days, and we actually shared our flat with my great-grandmother, so it was a bit of a crammed space.
Again, appropriate given the film we've chosen.
Yes, exactly. So that whole thing of, you know, having your quite small kitchen as the heart of the flat, and that's where all the cooking and the socializing happens. And then if my parents had guests for a dinner party, then they'd be in the kitchen as well. And, you know, it was this really amazing social, almost like a magical space for the kids, because, you know, at times you were not allowed to go there because the grown-ups were smoking, and, you know, so that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, the kitchen became a real heart of the family. And I guess in my memories of my childhood now, the kitchen really is that first... Oh, there we are. That first space that I think of when I think of my childhood. So it's interesting to think that, you know, there's a big trend to really criticize the Soviet days and kind of look back on it in horror and saying how terrible it was. But at the same time, out of all these constraints and restrictions came some really beautiful moments of community and, you know, sharing of food and that connection between generations that we don't have now at all. Even though by many standards it's not healthy to live with your parents and your grandparents in the same flat.
But having, striking a balance between, you know, being able to spend quality time with people, and, you know, obviously it's a cliche, but the older generation have so much life experience and, you know, the wisdom built up from that. They lived through different challenges, but there's, you know, universal human stuff.
Definitely.
And that's something I kind of appreciate more as I get older. And I also feel kind of sad that I didn't get in that all of my grandparents were gone by the time I was, I guess, 21. So, and yeah, 3 out of 4 were gone before I was 15. So, yeah.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, my wife still has 3 out of 4 of her grandparents.
Oh,
so,
that's great.
And we don't see them very often as they live over in the States. But yeah, spending time with them has been great. And it's been something that I've, yeah, like I say, kind of missed out on in my own life. But yeah, sorry, I went into a bit nostalgia trip there. Oh gosh, yeah, where can we go from there though? I guess I wanted to say, as far as your great grandma, I mean, just cooking on a scale, if you're cooking in a canteen and still making it good, must have been quite a challenge.
Yeah It's quite funny. We always remember with my mum that I forgot where exactly she worked. I think she worked at the whole sorts of different canteens. But in a few places, they say, oh, when, you know, when this lady's on duty, the food always tastes a lot better. And then my granny said, well, actually, that's because I don't take half of the ingredients out of the kitchen with me in a backpack when I go home, you know, because obviously, you know,
right,
the guests stealing reappropriating ingredients for your personal use was quite a common thing in Soviet canteens.
Yeah,
it's been a bit of a kind of notorious thing about Soviet public cooking, or whatever you can call it.
And the black market in general, from what I understand, it's kind of like whatever job you did, it gave you access to the supplier of a certain commodity that you couldn't just necessarily buy everywhere else. And so that was kind of like the thing that you could, like,
absolutely,
hoard
yeah.
and trade with people yeah, when yeah. you needed something. So
yeah, there was definitely this, as you say, a kind of a black market thing for food. You know, when you know someone who knows someone that can get you a fresh chicken, or I know it's a fascinating thing that
how a system designed in a certain way just has completely unintended consequences. Like, because the idea that Western journalists would get going to supermarkets, or the equivalent of supermarkets, in the late Soviet Union, like the 80s, would be just like, there's hardly anything on the shelves. And it's like, yes, there were problems with production, but it wasn't just that there were problems of production. It was just often stuff not making it to the shelves,
exactly,
because
yes.
they would just, things would just go walkabout because it was...
Absolutely.
It was more valuable to you if you were working in the shop to be able to trade that with somebody
exactly.
under the table than, you know, pathetic wages that you'd get as the employee there. So,
Yeah.
Although just picking up the thread of the positive sides of the Soviet Union, certainly doing this podcast, and goodness me, I don't want to be an apologist for it because there, you know, it was in many ways an oppressive regime. But I think sometimes the Cold War Western propaganda, you know, to our own side, well, I say my own as you know, somebody who grew up here, was so successful that it managed to convince all of us that just every waking moment in the Soviet Union was just utter grey, dank, you know, squalid misery. And watching the films that I've watched, it's kind of like, no, people were still able to produce artistic, you know, joyous stuff.
Absolutely.
And people would have enjoyed going to watch those. Yeah, there was a censorship thing, which meant that you couldn't necessarily express yourself in the way that you wanted to. But sometimes you could get away with surprising stuff. Like recently, well, by the time this episode goes up, it won't be that recently, but covering Welcome or No Trespassing. And it's just incredibly scathing in an indirect way about the...
It's fantastic, isn't it? And it's almost, in a way, it's interesting to have some kind of form of restrictions. And there are lots of artists who have self-imposed restrictions in order to kind of, you know, challenge their creativity because they believe that having some kind of challenge and some kind of restrictions is only productive and it actually inspires you to do something a lot more interesting. I think Lars von Trier had this Five Challenges film series or something like that.
Yeah. Was that the Dogme? Like set of rules.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, they obviously did not have any censorship imposed by the government, so they decided to create their own, you know, little censorship, create, you know, in terms of kind of technological tricks that they were using, but still it's kind of within the same, I guess, stream of thought that it is a useful thing sometimes.
Yeah, to have some parameters within which you're working. I always found it at school easier to write an essay if I had the question rather than I had an exercise of just, you know, just create something.
Yeah.
What am I creating? Oh, anything you want. It's like, oh, what do I even want? But yeah, speaking of creating things, your book, so that's called Salt and Time. And
yes.
I mean, I understand that sort of came out of doing the film club Kino Vino, but not exactly, because, you know, I should be clear, you don't only do Russian films for the film club.
No.
Limit your appeal, which I can relate to doing this podcast.
Yeah, especially in terms of food, yeah. It's only Russian food. The Kino Vino project, even though it has initially a Russian-sounding name...
Yes. I'm always wanting to pronounce it Kino Vino.
Yes, you can say that as well.
Yeah.
But it sounds a bit more exotic when you say Kino Vino. I like
Kino
that.
Vino.
Well, to me at least it sounds more exotic. So the project itself, it has pretty much nothing to do with Russian culture as such. I mean, I have done a few Russian ones, yes, but, you know, it's not the main theme, and the whole point is to kind of create as diverse an experience as possible, so from Mexican to Chinese and, you know, everything in between. But from that, just from working with chefs and cooking more myself, kind of just getting the experience and the courage and the confidence to put together a set of recipes that I've created myself, and then just the people that I've met. And obviously, you know, in order to publish a book, you have to have a bit of a name in the industry. You can't just zero. Even, you know, you can have the most amazing story, but if you're completely unknown, then it's a bit hard. And, you know, it's only been 4 or 5 years that I've started this. So I'm still not, you know, as established as other people that I have worked with and, you know, aspire to be one day. But, so yes, I mean, and kind of all these experiences put together and a bit of connections within the industry led to a book proposal and an agent. And again, luckily, I've had a really great response from the publishers, which really, you know, only reassured me that, the time definitely was right for it, because I just suddenly, it was about 2 years ago, just suddenly had this, like, eureka moment that I have to do a Russian cookbook, because I just felt like, you know, it's such a brilliant idea and it's kind of floating around and no one has grabbed it yet. So if I don't do it now, someone else will definitely come in very soon.
Yes, especially with the way that I guess audiences have kind of like atomized. There's definitely going to be an interest for a particular niche area. So if you don't get to it, you like you say, somebody will. So yeah. I'm sure this is the question that you get all the time, so I apologize for the unoriginality of it, but what's the idea behind the title Salt and Thyme?
Sure. No, it's a good question. The initial idea is a reference to the process of fermentation, because it's such a key element of Russian cuisine and something that I grew up eating, and it dates back to the Middle Ages. So, you know, if you were to define the essence of Russian cuisine, then fermentation is definitely one of the key strands of that.
I mean, short growing season and all that, relatively speaking, to some places.
Exactly. There's so many reasons why fermentation is such a key element. At the time when I was making my transition into food, it just seemed like all of a sudden everyone was fermenting and everyone was talking about kraut and kefir and kombucha. And to me, it almost sounded very amusing because, you know, it was my standard, you know, not very original or let alone trendy diet when I was growing up in the Soviet Union. It was more about the shortage of things. We kind of had no choice but to ferment.
Yeah, it's the thing that the old folks
exactly.
are in charge of. Yeah.
And so I thought, well, that's quite fun to find, you know, use that connection as a way of introducing Russian food into contemporary British eating culture. And I started doing a few pop-ups where, you know, the menu would have fermented something, you know, there would be each dish on the menu would have a fermented element to it. And I called those pop-ups Salt and Thyme as a reference to this magic of cooking with nothing but salt and thyme. And then when my idea for the book came about and the proposal, I used that as my working title. And then the more I thought about it, I felt like it's actually a really beautiful poetic name as well that makes you think of, well, at least makes me think of the snow. Salt and snow have that visual and also the kind of sonic affinity in a way, you know, the crushing of the salt and the crunching of the snow.
Oh,
and then,
yeah.
Thyme, I mean, it's an absolutely essential cooking element. And also to me, in my personal story, it took time for me to reconnect with my Russian identity in a way. And food was a huge part of that process. So I felt like on so many levels, it's such a brilliant title that really kind of goes down to the essence of Russian cuisine, but also of my personal relationship to Russian cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, and they're two such basic ingredients of life.
Yeah, yeah.
You can go through life probably quite easily without encountering, say, kombucha, if you just don't happen to, you know, live in a culture that's connected with that, or you don't live somewhere that's particularly cosmopolitan, but basically everywhere has salt. And, yeah. But as far as the marketing of the book, have I got this right? You toyed with or considered calling it a Siberian cookbook, but decided against that in the end.
My thinking was initially not to use the word Russian because it's such a complex term in general.
Sure.
You know, when it comes to food and that whole question of, you know, national belonging of food or where the food comes from. You know, it's the whole kind of PhD field of, you know,
Should you decide to do another one?
Exactly, yeah. So they kind of...
Might be a bit more fun than the Holocaust
definitely,
one.
Definitely, yeah.
if I can, you know, not be too flippant, but yeah.
Yeah, so I felt that, you know, might be more... relevant to my own history, I suppose, or my own experience, to just use the word Siberian because that's where I come from.
Sure.
And
there's a certain novelty there. People go,
yes,
oh,
exactly. And I felt it's quite
that?
A, you know, quirky thing to say. But then when I started telling people about my project, and people like, oh yeah, Siberia, that's a lovely place next to Croatia. And I was like, oh, okay.
Really?
So then this
people
whole...
people getting Serbia and Siberia mixed up. Huh.
So I was like, okay, that's not good. And then the other thing that my publisher said, and I trust them completely, that marketing, you know, is such a huge part. And that, yes, we definitely can't use... Well, not definitely, but we would risk a lot of misunderstanding and confusion if we have Siberia on the title.
And associations, right?
Yeah.
It's like people, you know, for people who don't misidentify it as Serbia, if you say Siberia to the average Brit or American and just say, what do you associate it with? They'll probably say something like exile and gulag.
Yes, exactly.
Which is awful. And you know, and winter.
Yeah, so, not appetizing in the slightest.
No. You know, 333 things to do with cooking with snow or something stupid like
exactly.
that. Yeah, exactly. Interesting point about Russian food being a broad term. I mean, I guess it's you could say there's a slight analogy with British food in that you can choose to define it quite narrowly or quite broadly. I mean, maybe this is just a thing with countries that had a big empire at
exactly.
one point.
Yeah, I was going to say the whole colonial past definitely feeds into that.
Yeah, like I forget which curry dish it is. I want to say it's chicken tikka was developed by South Asian immigrants in Birmingham.
Yes, I want to say
so. It's not a dish that was born physically
exactly
in the Indian subcontinent,
yeah.
But it was, you know, out of people who were originally from that part of the world. So yeah, similarly with Russia, you know, if you go back 400-500 years, it's a much smaller place and encompasses a much less diverse range of ethnicities.
Yes.
And from, you know, doing a little bit of research and just stuff I knew from living in Russia, although I never made it out to Siberia, I'm sad to say, a trip to Baikal was on the on the to-do list for a long time and never made it. But my understanding is that Siberia, partly because of the exile thing, to be honest, ended up being quite a melting pot, and that's kind of reflected in the cuisine.
Yes.
Yeah, could you develop that a little bit?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about Siberia, so even though the book says Russian on the title, and again, you know, just so complex to try and define what's Siberian, what's Russian, you know, it's all part of something a lot more kind of fluid and complex. I still talk about the food as being Siberian purely because that's where I come from, and that's the food that I grew up eating.
Sure.
And most of the recipes in the book are kind of based on my family recipes, but there is also some research into pre-revolutionary cuisine and treating all of these recipes with a more contemporary touch from kind of me as a chef working in London today.
Sure.
But still, Siberia is the kind of a framework, a thematic framework for the book. And the fascinating thing is that, as you rightly said, people associate it mostly with exile. But because of that, it's a fascinating thing that so many different kind of ethnic groups and people of all sorts of cultural and religious backgrounds kind of pass through Siberia.
Well, and often quite creative people, because creative people tend not to be as willing to keep their heads down and not attract attention, as you know. I don't, you know, all people are creative to a degree. I don't want to say you've got creative people and then just kind of the lumpen rest of the population. But you know, some people it's more central to you know, their identity and their self-perception and whatever. Creative types more likely to, you know, attract the ire of the authorities, even if they're doing nothing particularly, to challenge it. You know, if you're a paranoid guy like Stalin, it's just like, I don't like the fact that you're not just falling into line. Anyway, yes. So sorry, I think I sidetracked.
Oh,
that.
No worries.
Happens when you mention the S word. Yeah.
So Siberia just happened to have the most interesting kind of anthropological almost history in terms of the migrants moving from the Far East to the West and vice versa. You know, personally, in my family, my dad's side comes from the Far East of Russia, and my mom's side comes from, well, there's a bit of mix there, but the main part of the family comes from Ukraine. And there were Jews who moved to Siberia from Ukraine during the Holocaust, or escaped somehow, miraculously escaped the Holocaust.
Sure.
So even in my own family, it's a really interesting example of the kind of East and West of Russia, or former Soviet Union, rather, meeting in one place. And of course, there's so many other families who have similar stories, or similar in a way that they kind of came from, you know, all parts of the former Soviet Union and settled in Siberia. Mm. And because of that, you know, there are so many interesting dishes and influences. You know, like, it's very uncommon to think that Korean pickles and the whole culture of Korean style food preservation is very popular in Russia and in Siberia. But if you ask anyone who comes from the former Soviet Union, you know, do they like Korean pickles? And they'll say, oh my God, this is like one of the best things that we always have. And, you know, in any market you go, you'll see a dedicated Korean pickle stall with like all those beautiful mountains of pickled carrots and tofu skins and cabbage and all sorts of stuff. So that's quite a fascinating thing. And then where I come from, the place Omsk, it's quite close to Kazakhstan. So the Soviet Central Asian cuisine was very common, kind of as far as I can remember.
Yeah, you have plov, of course.
And so, yeah, there's so many kind of almost street food style canteens that serve really lovely soups and dumplings and plovs. And just in general, when you go to the market, it's such a beautiful kind of diversity of faces, you know, Asian, Russian, Georgian. You know, it's just a really fascinating notion of the melting pot that's really encapsulated in the market scene.
Yeah, when we were living in Moscow, we'd quite often go to an open-air market, and our favourite stall there was run by a Georgian lady, so we would get sulugoni Georgian cheese there, which was very good. What else did we have? And I mean, she didn't sell khachapuri, but that was one of, in terms of my culinary journey, learning about Georgian food.
Yeah, that's a huge revelation, isn't it?
This is probably like the fourth or fifth time I've mentioned it on the podcast. it's you know, sorely, you know, not known about. I feel like it's kind of sad. But going to the Korean thing, that was something I was very surprised about. Just in general, I wasn't aware of the modern Russian Federation, and to an extent, the Soviet Union's. I mean, obviously, the Soviet Union was even more ethnically diverse. But I think I certainly had sort of got into my head that when the Soviet Union collapsed, that basically, you know, all the people who weren't Russian had just gone, we don't like you guys anymore, so we're leaving, bye.
Yeah.
So that everyone was left, you know, almost, with the exception of, say, the Chechens, was like ethnic Russian now, which is obviously very far from the truth. So, yeah, that was kind of interesting. And just because you don't tend to think about, again, if you grew up here, or how far Russia stretches, you know, over that way, over towards the right on the map, and you are right by Korea. So I just didn't realize that there was any sizable population of Koreans. And one of the dishes that you have in the book is called, I'm probably butchering the pronunciation, but is it hye? So what's that one?
So that's another classic from the Korean market stall. It's essentially, I call it a Soviet Korean ceviche, because it's essentially it's a very thinly sliced fish, raw fish, that's then marinated in a mix of vinegar, spices and sugar, and it's served with a fresh grated carrot and fried onion, and that kind of combination of a fried onion with coriander and sunflower oil, which is then mixed together with very pungent garlicky cayenne peppery acid, is quite a funny combination, because one side is very kind of Slavic, if we can call it that, you know, very more traditional Russian, and then obviously the whole sugar, garlic, acid and cayenne pepper that's a lot more Korean.
And the ceviche-like thing of, you know, for people not familiar, I've never actually had ceviche, but I know conceptually, the cooking without heat idea.
So it cooks the fish completely because it's very thinly sliced, and obviously the acid is quite a strong element. And it's a beautiful thing together when it's mixed together, because there's a bit of sweetness and subtlety from the onions and the coriander, and then this really sharp, sweet flavor from the fish. And yeah, it's quite amazing. I love it. They also make it with pork, pig's ears, but I've never tasted it myself, so I think it's a bit risky.
That sounds a bit more of a challenge. Yeah.
So I decided not to have include that in the book.
Yeah, it didn't quite make the shortlist.
No. And then obviously the whole tradition of eating raw fish, it's also quite common.
I was hoping you'd bring this up.
Common in Siberia itself. So there's something that I kind of sadly bypassed in the book for various reasons, well, namely not having enough time to do proper research, is the indigenous culture in Siberia, because there's so many indigenous ethnic groups that live. And obviously it's important to remember that Siberia is huge. So when we say Siberia, there's also so much variation to that. So, you know, throughout the whole of Siberia, there's so many different ethnic groups who have their own culture and culinary traditions and so on. And without doing much research specifically into that, the only dish that really kind of is well known and is now commonly eaten across the whole Russia is a thing called straganina, which, again, is raw fish. But in this case, it's actually frozen raw fish. And so you would get fresh fish and then you freeze it, which seems a bit counterintuitive, but it's actually a really beautiful moment when you thinly shave it and then have it with the whole bunch of condiments like horseradish cream, really coarse sea salt, pickled onions or fresh onions. And then that whole sensation of the really cold, ice-cold fish that gradually melts and turns into this really lovely sweet thing in your mouth. It's quite sensational. And I feel like in the book, people might look at it and think, oh, that's a bit weird. But I really encourage you to give it a try, and especially if you can have it with a shot of vodka, because that's just the best thing.
Yes, I was going to say, I'd read that it's quite common as a chaser with vodka. And that I wasn't aware of prior to moving to Russia was how important the zakuski, the snacks when you're having a bit of a session is.
Yeah, I think that's another misconception about Russian, I guess, eating, drinking culture, that, you know, yes, we do drink vodka and it's a very strong spirit, but how we do it is a whole different story. You know, here it's very common to just have it on the rocks in the pub or in the nightclub, which I completely don't understand. whereas, you know, in Russia you would have that drink as part of a bigger gastronomic kind of ceremony. And I mean, of course, there are people who do drink vodka, you know, behind a garage somewhere, standing, you know, and smoking. You know, that happens too. I'm not saying that all the Russians did. They have a ceremony with vodka. Of course, there's a whole range of relationships to alcohol in every country. But when it's done well, it's a really amazing moment when you have a specific set of dishes. It's a bit like tapas kind of thing. So it's all little, or relatively little plates, you know, so it's not like an individual plate. It's all sharing plates and platters of ferment and pickles and things like straganina.
Some nice rye bread.
Yes, rye bread and horse, you know, so things that have very strong, I guess, very strong flavors. And kind of hit your palate on different angles. And then vodka is an amazing cleanser for the receptors on your tongue. So when you have a shot of vodka, it really kind of strips it of all its memory that it's, you know, ever tasted before. And then you have that most amazing experience of tasting the flavor of each ingredient in that particular zakuski meal, you know, as if it was your first time. And it's so, you know, pungent and strong and nuanced at the same time. So I think that's why I love drinking vodka with a specific meal and not just having it on the rocks, standing at a pub or something.
Yeah, you're right. That does sound a lot more appealing. I'm really glad that you brought up the Stroganina side of things, because that was definitely one of the things that I went, oh, that sounds super interesting. And the raw fish thing, that was something I was, again, quite surprised about when I initially moved to Moscow, was just how popular Japanese restaurants of a kind were. It's very, like, Russianized.
Yeah, it's quite interesting to see this trend. Well, it's been around for at least 15 years now, I think. When the first sushi restaurant opened in Omsk, where I'm from, it was really a mega special occasion kind of venue. And it was always, you know, fully booked, and you would actually get quite decent sushi there. But then gradually that particular style became so popular that, and yes, as you say, it has become Russianized in a way that you get cream cheese and all sorts of stuff in it. And also just the way it's available literally on every street corner. It's almost become like a kind of Russian street food, really. You know, you get a coffee shop and a sushi bar in one place, and they come up with all sorts of funny kind of Russianized names, like sushi bambushi or something. It's just or babushi or whatever, you know. It's just really silly kind of play on Japanese and Russian words. Yeah, but it's interesting that at the same time that dish stroganina is also becoming quite trendy and starting to kind of rival the sushi mania. And yeah, it's quite fun to see something that's very regional, kind of belongs to the indigenous population of Siberia, suddenly becoming, well, not suddenly, but, you know, it has been around for a long time. But I think the whole kind of immersive experience of a stroganina bar is quite a recent phenomenon. And it's definitely a rival to the sushi bars.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess that's something that's developed since I left Moscow 5 years ago, or maybe it was starting, it was kind of bubbling up under the surface, but yeah, it wasn't something that had really come to my attention. So going from slightly dodgy cream cheese infused sushi, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the negative perceptions of Russian food over here. Was that something you found a challenge in terms of, like, writing the book and marketing the book? Because I know maybe for British audiences it doesn't have the most, like, oh, let's have some Russian food kind of.
Oh, absolutely. It's quite a challenge, because you don't want to sound too negative in the book, you know, saying so in the introduction that, you know, most people in the West think that Russian food is pretty horrible, or even a chef who are not from the West, I have heard them say on various programs that Russian food is pretty bad. So yeah, you don't want to kind of drive that message home too much in the book, even if my intention is to then contradict it. So I was trying to tread carefully around that subject. And I think my hope is to show just authentic food, and then, you know, let people, you know, decide for themselves if it's good or bad. And by authentic, I mean something that's authentic to me. I'm not claiming to have the ultimate recipe for the authentic, you know, Russian iconic authentic food. I think that kind of term itself is problematic. By authentic, I mean kind of honest to me, to my palate, to my memory of my family and my family's recipes, and just present something that fascinates me, that excites me, that I love cooking at home, and hopefully that kind of honest kind of energy behind it will come through, and people will kind of feel the need or the interest to explore if they haven't had any Russian food before. So the jury's still out.
I have been getting lots of really wonderful messages on social media and have been tagged in lots of posts where people, you know, cook something from the book and then post about an Instagram, which was really touching, and lots of lovely reviews on Amazon. The book only had 5-star reviews so far. So, I mean, that's really encouraging and really, just makes me really happy.
Oh, that's great. I'm really glad to hear that it's been well received so far and that people are being open-minded about Russian food. I wonder if some of the residual negative perception of Russian food that I sometimes encounter over here comes from the fact that a lot of British establishment journalists who are middle-aged at this point may well have visited the Soviet Union in the 80s. I mean, you were on Women's Hour at the time of recording recently, and she'd visited there and not come away with the most favourable impression of Russian cooking, partly because of, you know, Stolovaya canteens. And you mentioned the, I think, on their tendency to smother everything in mayonnaise, and that was something that you were very keen to get away from.
Yes, I do have a bit of a love-hate relationship with mayonnaise. Historically, mayonnaise was quite easy to produce during the Soviet days, produce en masse using egg powder and so on. Obviously, we're not talking about handmade fresh mayo with fresh eggs and stuff. We're talking about proper kind of industrial, everything comes out of a packet type of mayonnaise. And yes, it's been used really widely because it's the best way to mask, certain ingredients which might not be the freshest, or, you know, if there's a salad that initially supposed to use chicken meat, chicken breast, for example. But of course, getting, you know, good quality chicken breast back in the Soviet day was quite hard. So instead, a lot more mayo would be used. And then maybe things like the doctor's sausage, the iconic Soviet doctor's sausage, would be used instead. Or a very kind of poor quality chicken would be used, but then because there's lots of mayo, it wouldn't really kind of strike you as much. but in the book, I liked looking kind of at the heart of the recipe. What are the actual ingredients? And luckily these days we have access to very good quality ingredients, and just kind of stripping it back and letting the ingredients sing for themselves. One of the recipes that I particularly like is based on an iconic Soviet mayo salad. I don't know how you can actually call it a salad because it's just as heavy as anything. It's basically a black radish that's fried with onions. It gets this most amazing, sharp, yet very sweet flavor because of that. And then there's some boiled beef. And then all of that gets smothered in mayo, and it's very delicious.
Awesome. So we should probably move along to talking about the film side of things. So we've alluded a couple of times to the film that you've brought along, but this one you actually did show at Kino Vino, is that right?
Yes, I did. It is one of my most favourite films, and it's been a dream of mine to show it at Kino Vino, but I just didn't have the occasion. And then back in March, when my book came out, I decided to do a Kino Vino dedicated to that. So being a curator and a chef at the same time. And I thought, what can be better than showing my most favourite film at this particular edition of Kino Vino? And you kind of forget how amazing it is, and, you know, it's funny and, you know, it's entertaining, but it also has so much heart and honesty in it. And, you know, it's quite emotionally really moving and quite hard at the end. So I think my guests really went on a most amazing emotional journey through the film. And then we had a lovely Russian meal too. Balance it all out. So it was quite a fun night.
Oh, cool. And it's great that you got to share a film that people wouldn't necessarily have heard of or sought out, perhaps.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because it would have been very easy as far as, you know, picking a filmmaker that people in London had heard of, just going, okay, Tarkovsky it is then. But, I mean, I haven't seen all of Tarkovsky's films yet, but I can't think of a big food connection with any of them.
No, Tarkovsky doesn't really have much food in his films, but when I had Kino Vino dedicated to my favourite, another favourite film, Mirror, together with my dear friend and amazing chef, Olio Hercules. We kind of went for the sensuality of the film, really, and the whole theme of mothers and the memories, because obviously for most of us, food is such a strong connection to our childhood and our mothers, because we probably are fed by, most of us are fed by our mums. And that kind of gave us really beautiful creative freedom. But at the same time, Mirror is most of the scenes connected to the author's childhood are set in a beautiful buckwheat field. And Tarkovsky writes a lot in his diaries about all those beautiful memories he has running through the fields. And just, you know, that buckwheat field is really a strong character. And obviously buckwheat as an ingredient is a huge part of Russian and Soviet diet. And there is a short scene in the film where you see children, well, Tarkovsky and his sister, essentially, eating a buckwheat porridge, a most traditional thing that we all ate as kids, even though, you know, some 70 years separate me and Tarkovsky. You know, it's a very simple boiled buckwheat with sugar, a bit of butter and milk. So kind of like a cereal, really. And we use that scene as a departing point. And it was just a really brilliant coincidence that Olya was actually developing a recipe for an ice cream based on that iconic Soviet porridge. So what could be better?
Yeah, buckwheat was one of those things that I'd never really had until I moved out to Russia. But then, you know, I discovered it. And of course, you know, it's kind of funny that it's like a health wonder food over here. But in Russia, it's just, a, you know, a standard thing that you eat all the time. I guess going back to food and Russian films, the only thing that readily springs to mind is the less than great beef in Eisenstein, but maybe that's not the connotation you want to go for.
Funny you should say that Battleship Potemkin borscht with the maggots and the meat. I actually had a really weird anxiety dream recently where I think it was like my academic past meeting my current kind of cooking present, where I was doing a Kino Vino type event at an academic conference dedicated to Battleship Potemkin, and I was cooking borscht, a ginormous pot of borscht which wouldn't boil, and I was just so stressed that there wouldn't be enough time to cook it, but there were no maggots there. But yeah, it was just funny that you can always find some kind of a food connection in the most non-foodie films like Eisenstein's work.
Yes, life imitating art imitating life, or yes. But anyway, back to the film. So the film is Little Vera, or Malenkaya Vera, and so that one is directed by Vasily Pichul. Am I pronouncing that right?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Okay, so what we'll do, if this is your first time joining us, we will say a little bit of Russian, and that word that we say is poyekhali, which means
let's go. Well, let's start.
Yeah, awesome. And it's kind of like a famous phrase because, I mean, it's something that people said anyway, and that's why he said it, but it's what Yuri Gagarin said when he was just about to become the first man in space, because it's like, off we go. Okay, so, 3, 2, 1.
Поехали.
Поехали.
Что случилось?
Ничего.
And we're back. We have just watched Little Vera, directed by Vasily Pichul. And before we get on to discussing what we thought about it, we're going to have a quick plot summary from Alyssa. So this is the point where if you haven't watched it and don't want to know what happens, spoiler alert, don't say we didn't warn you.
So the film is set over a summer and it focuses on a young woman called Vera who just finished school and she's a bit lost about what to do next. She's living with her parents, an alcoholic father and a hardworking mum. And then at one of the local dances, she meets a dashing young gentleman called Sergei, who is a student. He lives in a local student accommodation, and they start a passionate love affair, which leads to marriage. Vera tricks her parents into thinking that she's pregnant, and they allow her to marry him, and then Sergei moves in with them. And the whole experience of living with the parents obviously kills the romance pretty quickly. And their relationship starts to fall apart. And after a series of massive arguments, Vera's dad stabs Sergei. And this is a really testing moment for Vera, you know, whether she sticks with her family or her new husband. And after some really heartbreaking encounters with her parents, the film kind of doesn't really have a conclusion. It's a very bleak ending where Vera attempts a suicide and Sergei comes back from a hospital and her father is alone in the kitchen drinking and he actually dies of a heart attack.
Yeah, he collapses and yeah, we're led to believe that he probably died, yeah.
Yes, that he probably died, yeah. So it's a very bleak, kind of inconclusive ending, which, stays with you for a really long time. Very powerful.
Yeah, yeah. And it's there's a bitter irony to that ending in that just after you've got the sense that maybe Sergei, Seryozha and Vera are going to, you know, give it one more go. So it's kind of like, oh, there's a ray of light. Mm. Nope, we're slamming the blinds down on that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, there isn't. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Alyssa, for that wonderful, concise summary. So, yeah, as we've already established, kind of a bleak and in many ways sort of depressing film. And in fact, it falls within like a category of late Soviet /
yes,
early post-Soviet filmmaking. I want to say called Chernuha, is that right?
Yes, correct. Yep.
Yeah, and which comes from Chorny, which means black. So it's kind of like a negative, you know, dismal, depressing kind of like, I mean, to call it a genre is the wrong word, but I mean, category.
Yeah, I suppose it's a wave of films that came about in the late 80s when Gorbachev's policy of glasnost, so open speech, like free speech,
yeah,
and the pretty much the collapse of the centralized censorship system of the film industry led to this whole new wave of films which could finally speak out about the reality of the Soviet experience. And I mean, a lot of praise for Little Vera goes towards that kind of honest depiction, but I think there were films before it, of course. It wasn't the first Soviet film to openly depict, you know, the reality of the experience of the young people in the Soviet regime, but I guess this one was more overt, maybe more kind of in your face. It has that kind of amazing young energy because the director was quite young himself.
Yeah, he was like
27. Yeah, yeah.
And his and it was actually written by his wife.
Yeah, and it's based on it's shot in his hometown. It's actually in Ukraine, in Mariupol or Zhdanov,
yes,
as it used to be known.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much based on his own life, and the character of the mum And there's actually kind of an anecdote that when the director's mum saw the film, she got really upset because obviously that the character of the mum in the film is very much inspired by the director's own mother, and she's not shown in the best of lights.
Yes, yeah. More autobiographical than she probably felt was necessary. And I think that's a relatively common complaint with artists' relatives. Like, sometimes things just get a little bit too much. Okay, art inspires life, but, you know, you're kind of doing the laundry in public kind of thing. Vasily Pichul's wife was, just for the record, Maria Chmelik, I think. Yes, yeah. Just wanted to give credit where credit's due. And I imagine there's probably like a certain amount of autobiography there, actually, you know, in it centering around a young woman and being written by a woman. Yeah. And to me, one of the things that came across is it seemed like there was a strong thread of criticism of masculinity in a way.
Oh, definitely. It's worth saying that the title itself, Little Vera, has a kind of a dual meaning, because Vera is a word faith in Russian as well as a woman's name. So Little Vera is either, you know, young Vera, the character, or the lack of faith, really, or the lack of future is just... Yeah, I guess the whole bleakness is definitely the word that it's very characteristic of the film.
Yeah, you could almost switched her name up to Nadezhda, which means hope, achieved a similar effect.
Exactly.
And obviously with Russian, well, I say obviously, Russian not having articles, you can't say a little faith because you don't have a, so it has that ambiguity, like you say. And yeah, I just wanted to say the men in this film are all pigs. I mean, all of the characters you get, there's a strong, like, none of the characters come off particularly well, but I think like the men in particular are just just awful.
Yeah.
In
I guess the
way.
Whole, yeah, this idea of, lack of a strong father figure or a leader. But at the same time, I mean, I've seen the film, I don't know how many times, many, many times, and...
Yes, I was going to say, this was more than like a third or fourth watch for you, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely, countless amount of times. But as any good film, you know, you see something new each time you see it, and the film kind of evolves with
yeah, you. I was gonna ask, actually, was there anything this time that you went, huh, not spotted that before?
Well, to me, I think the relationship between Vera and her parents... was initially, and I guess also as you grow older, maybe, because I first saw it when I was in my late teens, maybe, so I didn't obviously see it when it came out. It came out in 1988,
no.
And I was a bit too young for a film like
yes.
that. But I did, it was my kind of parents' favourite film because they saw it then. But yeah, so I saw it the first time when I was in my late teens, and I was initially...
About the same age as Vera, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so the same age as Vera, and I was definitely kind of on her side, seeing parents as negative characters. But more recently, I kind of started to see a more nuanced relationship between them. And, as bad as her father is in so many ways... there is something very vulnerable and very moving about him and about their relationship. That scene where, in the beginning of the film, which is essentially, in a way, it's kind of like, because she chooses Sergei towards the end, she's not there to save the dad.
Yeah.
Because the film, it's almost like a cyclical kind of motif. The film begins with him drinking alone in the kitchen, and then she comes home and she puts him to bed, and he's also screaming that his heart is, you know, he's having like a heart attack and he's going to die.
Yes, yeah, it's very heavily foreshadows the ending.
Yeah, and she's there, you know, she puts him to bed, and even though she's very angry with him, there's still some kind of degree of tenderness between them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how he remembers when she was a little girl, you know, so there is some kind of, you can definitely sense it's her and the dad who have a stronger connection.
Yeah.
And so, to you know, so at the end when he's there again calling out her name, and again, you know, symbolically faith, you know, lack of faith. So neither the faith nor Vera, the girl, is there to save him or to, you know, be there for him. So I felt like that relationship is a lot more complex and
nuanced,
not as negative. Mm. Yes, exactly, as it might come across on the first viewing. And also the mum, I mean, you know, she's your standard Soviet woman.
Robust.
And yeah, and you know, she does what she thinks is best for her family. She works, she brings food, she cooks, you know, she does the ferments, of course. You know, for winter and for her, you know, for the dad to drink with vodka.
Yes.
And I love that conversation that Sergei has, you know, where he says, like, why are you making ferments for the dad? Because he's drinking vodka. She says, well, if I don't make ferments, he'll still drink. So, you know, what's the difference? At least we have some ferments.
Yeah, I think the implication seems to be that, like, at least this is kind of like breaking it up. It's slowing exactly, him down a little yeah. bit. Where
exactly.
And Seryozha's point is like, yeah, but if you didn't make it for him, he wouldn't have anything to, you know,
yeah.
and maybe you'd stop doing it. And she's like, no, it's not that simple. I mean, maybe yeah. I'm mischaracterizing it slightly, but...
No, I think that's... I kind of saw it that way as well. So, you know, her character is... She kind of does her best. And
yeah.
And it's, again, it's one of my favorite parts of the film is when Vera tells her that she's pregnant and that initial moment of... You know, anger is immediately followed by, oh, who do you want to have, a boy or a girl? And it's just such a, like, you know, it's such a silly thing to ask. but it also shows, like, her humane side, that she kind of, you know, they almost have this new connection. And she is quite caring, asking her about the sickness and, you know, kind of morning sickness and all of that. So there is some kind of humanity to the mum as well.
And I mean, everyone really, like... I get the impression that if you didn't watch this film carefully, you could just come away with the simplistic impression that just everyone hates each other because everyone's just yelling at each other the other time.
They're screaming a lot. Yeah. But that's quite a typical Russian family as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the level of...
Yes, they don't go in for the very stereotypically British middle class thing of just like... going off into a corner and silently resenting each other. No, just have it out.
Not that style. Yeah.
Although in some ways, this is almost like an advert for the British. Just repress everything, because when it all comes out, it can be really ugly and horrible.
Yeah.
Just bottle it all down inside. No, of course I'm joking, but yeah, like you say, there is that tenderness, and in general, it's a subtler film than. Certainly, I had been led to believe, and unfortunately, in a way, because it's almost like a notorious film, because it was the first Soviet film to have like a fairly explicit sex scene. Like that
yes.
seemed to be
yeah.
the thing that, you know, this is the problem with critical circles being dominated by men. Certainly, that was more the case when this film came out. They kind of all leapt on the fact of like, ooh, there are some boobs in this. And it's just like,
yes.
Exactly. Sorry. Just like, yeah. eye roll.
It's a shame, actually, that, yes, that the film was marketed or, you know, whether intentionally or not, I don't know, but as a kind of a, yeah, she's like the new sex symbol and the sex and the Soviet cinema. And it's so not what the film is about. So it's a bit of a shame that it kind of missed, you know, receiving more praise on so many more important things that it talks about.
Yeah, definitely. But certainly if you're the Western person, you know, charged with getting as many eyeballs pointed in the direction of this film, you can sort of understand the temptation to
sex sells,
yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And sex on the Soviet Union.
Yeah, yeah, because of course, like famously, "У нас секса нет" is there is no, or whichever version exactly. of that quote, "there's no sex in the Soviet Union"
yes.
thing
yeah.
had become, you know, quite famous a few years earlier with like the Telemost, like Telebridge broadcasts.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, yeah, funny from a marketing angle. But yeah, in terms of the tenderness with her dad, that scene where they have the very unsuccessful picnic.
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene, that.
Yeah. Or it just blows up and then Vera is lost in the rain and she's taken shelter under the kind of like beached boat, and her father comes and hugs her. It's like, yeah, there's like we've been saying, there's some nuance and there's different some tenderness. It's, you know, the family, they clearly love each other, but it's just often expressed in very kind of dysfunctional ways. Another standout scene, because I mean most of the scenes are worth talking about, but the like formal dinner that the parents put on just after Vera and Serioja have had their registry office marriage.
Oh, it's brilliant, yes.
That's most like the pivotal scene, I'd say. Like the fact that the parents and Vera and the older brother, Victor, they all dress up for the occasion. So even though they're not going out somewhere, but they're eating, it's, you know, obviously a paradoxical concept in the Soviet Union. Sunday best is kind of like how people would understand it here, maybe. They're dressed very formally. And of course, Serioja turns up in like a t-shirt and like Hawaiian shorts or something like that, and is just being very casual.
Yeah, he's just taking the piss. I love that scene precisely because of, you know, how we talked earlier about the social aspect of living in the Soviet Union and how cramped the apartments were, and that people only had their kitchen as the socializing space. But when you had a big event, if it's a wedding party or someone's jubilee, then dinner would be served in a living room. There would never be an extra dining room. That's a complete unheard of thing. It's very bourgeois. So like that scene, it's, you know, it really exemplifies, you know, my family had so many special meals in a living room where you kind of half of the family sits on the sofa and the table is put next to the sofa, and then you borrow chairs from the neighbours because you obviously don't have enough to accommodate everyone. And that's what's so beautiful about this film, that, you know, anyone who lived in the Soviet Union, they would immediately identify with that moment of this very special meal. Mm. And the best part, I think one of the things that it's a really small element, but I love it. And when I had the Kino Vino event dedicated to the film, I actually forgot to mention it. You see a beef eater bottle on their table.
I thought about that. Yeah, I noticed. I was like, because obviously the fact that it's not in Russian and in the Cyrillic alphabet just drew my eye. And I was kind of like, am I looking at that right?
Yeah, so that would be another thing that probably every Soviet family had. Again, how we talked about this black market thing. So maybe one person knew someone who knew someone who had the original beef eater gin, but they would only get the empty bottle because that in itself would be such a treasure to have. And then in that bottle, they would put their either the cheap vodka that they get from, you know, the local store, or even like homemade distilled drink of sorts. And there would be one bottle that would be kept as a treasure for years and passed on to, you know, your daughter's occasion, special occasion or something like that. And when we watched it recently with my mum again, she told me that she collected bottles like that. And she had like a bottle of whiskey that had tea in it. And she would change the tea to make sure that it doesn't go moldy and stuff. There was that kind of another element of where food, you know, food and drink culture had a very different significance to what us watching it now.
Once you can't get hold of something, it acquires a specialness.
Yeah.
In terms of collecting things, maybe I saw this wrong, but it seemed like Serioja, on the back of his door, on his room in the Obshchitie, the student dorm, he seemed to be collecting cigarette packets.
Yes, that's another thing that it was quite popular or common thing to do, is collecting all the foreign labels. And again, you probably wouldn't even have smoked the cigarettes yourself. But yeah, you had, you know, got hold of someone who gave you an empty packet. Or you would even borrow it for a bit and have it in your, you know, on your shelf and then pass it along to someone.
Yeah, that does actually remind me of my student days, in that I quite liked to... there was a couple of us on my corridor who did this, so, you know, just funny how sometimes you just end up landing with similar people. But we used to try to find obscure beers as we could, and so we would then, like, once we'd got them, we'd keep the bottles of trophies. I'm sure it was very unhygienic. I mean, I tried to rinse them out, but I'm not sure that always happened. So that was kind of like, oh, some student things are, you know, relatively universal, yeah. apparently.
Yeah.
Again, in terms of that scene, it descends into, you know, catastrophe, but it does have some of the humour. And there is, I wouldn't go as far as saying that this film's like a tragicomedy, because the element of tragedy is much stronger, but there is humour there.
Oh, absolutely.
And I love the bit where Serioja wanted to have some wine, and he was taking his time over it, and I think... Kolya, the dad, made some offhand comment about, like, you know, that he wasn't a very good drinker. And he was like, well, I like to sample the bouquet, which is a massively, like, pretentious thing to say. On the other hand, it does give Rita, the mother, the chance to do a brilliant little reaction. She just, like, either, like, raises her eyebrows and makes eye contact with her husband.
Oh, no, she actually says, like, Dad, you know, you should sample the bouquet, yeah.
And the implication there is just like, might be a good idea if some of the time you took your time over these.
Yeah.
There's a novel idea. I just love that, because she's, you know, not the most fun character, but the fact that the film does show that she has a sense of humour, and people aren't just a cardboard cutout. Like, and in general, with the film, like, I thought the first 10-15 minutes were quite full on and aggressive, and then it kind of mellows out a little bit, because I was thinking, is it going to be like this for 2+ hours? Because I'm not sure how I'm going to take that, but it does. After the initial, like, all the stuff with the police and, like, youths meeting up to have a fight, and just like, oh goodness, is this going to be like all sensationalist? And it's like, no, there's quieter.
Yeah, it has lots of
scenes,
different kind of moods going through it, doesn't it?
I wanted to ask, again, it connects with the dinner, but Kolya, the dad, says, "Forward with a song." And that comes back a couple of times in the film. Is that like a Soviet, like a reference to something, or...?
It's, well, his character is amazing. He is obviously a very, very simple guy who has a very limited vocabulary. And he just keeps saying the same things. It's kind of like, instead of saying cheers, he would have his own little quirky saying, "Вперед успешней," but...
And I think he says, "Как говорится," like, as they say.
All the time, yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, it is a bit of a nod to his, you know, lack of education, and it's something that Sergei really can't, you know, at first he kind of makes fun of it, but when he's actually stuck in the same apartment with this really narrow, uneducated guy, you know, that's why his real kind of anger comes out.
Although I have to say, of all the characters, I think Serioja was the one that I had the least sympathy with. Like the whole thing of when he just after they've been married, he just is talking to Vera, and he's just like, "Your parents are so dumb and they're so so boring." I'm kind of like, look, if you think that, you can't help thinking that. People have the impression on you that they have, but don't say that to your wife about her parents. I know she doesn't, ostensibly she doesn't get on with them, but it's just a very, like, insensitive, tone deaf, stupid thing to say. And it's just like, it's just, and I get the impression that he's probably just using Vera because he's a bit of a Lothario, and he kind of,
and I mean, he, you know, at least he gets his own room, and you know, I mean it's a lot, his action is a lot about the whole kind of flat situation, and, you know, living in the dorms with someone else is not I mean, it doesn't seem like his choice of living with Vera and her parents is a much better option, but at least, you know, they are treated as the newlyweds, and they have kind of the privilege of having the bedroom, and
the parents do try hard to accommodate them. Like, it's kind of funny in that it's almost like a reverse shotgun wedding, in the sense that it's not the parents that are I mean, you get the impression that the parents, you know, do pressure them to get married after Vera claims that she's pregnant. But I get the impression that Vera claims that she's pregnant in order to be able to get married, maybe. I don't know. Like, that she knows that that's how they'll respond and that will kind of give her the opportunity to... I mean, I could be reading that totally the wrong way. But you get the feeling that she really does love Sergei, and he, on the other hand, is kind of like, Vera is fun to be around, but at least initially doesn't feel that deeply for her, although, you know, he does come back at the end. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I really took against him. I mean, I think I kind of took against Vera initially, but then when I saw that scene of her helping her dad to bed and he makes the comment about, like, oh, remember when you were little and you used to, like, just prod me to... and the fact that she's just had to grow up dealing with this just made me a lot more, like, sympathetic to her plight. And I feel very sorry for Rita, the mother, as just having a husband who is an addict has got to be awful, but she's just kind of doing the best that she can.
And I think in the... kind of, so again, it's interesting, like, the difference of context. I mean, I'm not saying, again, that, like, being an alcoholic in the Soviet Union is fine, but it was, you know, like, his character would not have been seen as someone who is really problematic. You're like, yeah, he has a drink, he gets drunk, and then, you know, but he still works, and he still brings his bit of money. So, you know, he's not, like, a dysfunctional... He's a functioning alcoholic and pretty much... you know, in that probably kind of community, in that part of the country, people of, you know, who work in similar professions, they would have had that lifestyle of just coming home from work, getting drunk, passing out, and then
get up the next
going
day.
Off to work the next day. So it wouldn't have been seen as something completely, you know, that people kind of empathize with Rita because she has to struggle with an alcoholic husband. It would just been seen as like, well, that's kind of the reality of it, really.
And I think the whole, like, having a pretty brutal job in any like industrialized society has, and you know, not much time or money to go out and enjoy yourself in a more fulfilling way has kind of like tended to make people like rely on substances just to kind of like to kind of numb the experience.
Yeah, and I think from the emotion of the film, or like the director's point of view, I don't think he is, you know, he's not condescending in his depiction of characters, which I find really important. I feel there's kind of empathy towards everyone, and it's almost like it's the regime or the kind of outcome of the regime that's the problem.
Yeah.
It's not that any one character is a bad guy or, you know, on their own. It's more of a kind of history that they come out of or they live in. That's the problem. That's why the director kind of places the blame. But
yeah, they're kind of victims of circumstances rather than just being like, you know, quote unquote degenerates or whatever. You're right. He is definitely sympathetic. This is kind of an aside, but again, it goes with the small element of humor in the film. But I realise that I've been doing this podcast long enough that I get references, or I got a reference in this film to another Soviet film. There's a bit where they're on the beach having the picnic, and one of the characters, I forget who it is, says, "Vereshchagin, don't start the motor," which is which is a reference to White Son of the Desert, where the character Vereshchagin blows himself up inadvertently because the motor on like a boat has been rigged to go off. So I was kind of like, oh, that's kind of fun that they've snuck this reference to this cult Soviet film from, I guess, a couple of decades before in. So I like that.
Yeah. Well, that film is quite interesting in a way. I guess, you know, it's very realist in its aesthetic, so it really kind of absorbs all different reference to popular culture that would naturally be there. Like the music as well is very quite a strong like motif in the film. And it's Sofia Rotaru, who was, I mean, she's still around and kind of hasn't aged a day since then. So in the 80s, she was a huge, huge star. And the songs that feature in the film, those were like kind of her smash hits of the 80s. And yeah, just kind of the references in the dialogues as well. So yeah, it's a very kind of naturalistic film in that sense, that if you watch it, you do get a sense of kind of what they listen to, what kind of cultural atmosphere they existed in.
Yeah, the diegetic music as well. Mm. Yeah, as you say, you've got the kind of like late 80s kind of like almost like hair metal kind of stuff that they're listening to in public. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, wow, that really places the film in a very specific time period.
Yeah,
so I thought that was cool.
The fashion and, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Vera with her very big hair
and, yeah, fishnet tights and...
Yes, yeah, the fishnets. I think early... I don't know whether it's the first shot of her. I don't think it is, but early on you do get just this shot of these... I think it's two pairs of legs in fishnet tights.
Them at the disco, yeah, and then it just pans up from their feet to their faces, to that kind of loud... music that comes out of a very bad speaker, and it's like really like, really in your face. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, in terms of the visual and the cinematography, like, it didn't strike me as particularly flashy, but it also, it was very intimate and close in a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think, again, it feeds very well into this aesthetic of, you know, realist, naturalistic depiction that, you know, there's no self-referential or kind of overt technical elements in the film where you kind of stop and think, oh yeah, that was a cool camera or, you know, it's very, very subtle, very observational. I guess that maybe that scene that we just talked about at the disco where the camera pans up, it's done a bit for a comic effect, because, you know, you see the fishnet tights and then the faces when they're like crazy makeup, massive hair, and they all kind of have this very silly expression on their faces. So, you know, there are a few moments maybe where there is a bit of a comic effect. But other than that, it's all very subtle and, yeah, you know, it's just there. It's observing. It doesn't kind of force the style on you.
Yeah, and I liked how they almost used the shots of, like, the harbour and the, like, cranes and industrial, like, chimney stacks and stuff, almost like as punctuation, like a comma, like a breathing space between the scenes, like...
Different scenes, yeah. And it kind of just reinforces that sense of space, and it really, you know, really places you in that little, dark, polluted town.
Yeah, yeah. Because on the one hand, it's summer, and you have people referring to how hot it is, and quite a bit of time people are, you know, sitting around, in, especially the men, like in kind of boxer shorts and vests.
Yeah.
But yeah, you've kind of got this kind of bleak and kind of grimy, maybe kind of hotness to it. Which, again, yeah, for Western viewers who are used to stereotyping Russia and the former Soviet Union as being all cold all the time, is possibly a bit of like a, oh, that's normally what I associate definitely. It with, but...
Yeah,
I thought that was cool, because you didn't really need any of those little short sequences to be in there. You know, if you took them out, you'd probably cut the film down to just under 2 hours rather than
it's over two hours, isn't it? It's a bit long, yeah.
But it does, like you say, it gives you that extra atmosphere, I guess I'd say. This is the one thing I wanted to ask before we wrap things up. How did the dinner guests at Kino Vino react to this film? Did you get much of a chance to speak to them afterwards?
Yes, I almost wish I had more time. I mean, it's such a fantastic film that you want to have a kind of a discussion afterwards or something. I've had actually more than usual. I've had more questions and comments after the film than on any other event, really. And people were asking about where the film was set, because there was a very strong sense of place, and they were wondering, you know, again, I think they thought it was unusual for it to be by the sea, but, you know, again, maybe I mean, it is actually in Ukraine, modern-day in Ukraine, not in Russia.
A mere culpa in terms of, I like to, like, flag up at the beginning if we do a film that's not strictly set in Russia, but I wanted to say that... It's Russian language and...
Yes.
Natalia Nyagorda was born in Moscow, and I think Maria Melik was also...
I mean, the actors are...
Mostly born in Russia, yeah.
I mean, yeah, if we go into the, you know, the details, it's like ethnically Russian, but again, maybe they have non-Russian relatives. I don't know, but I think in that sense, it's more productive to just call it Soviet, because that's what it was. But
Yeah. And Vasily Pichul was actually from Zhdanov, modern-day Mariupol, so it was kind of like a local, like autobiographical in that sense, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. So it was set in where he was from, and his mom also worked as a, I think, on the one of the like local telecom stations or whatever. I think that's so it's very autobiographical. Yeah.
Yeah, but you were saying, sorry, before I sidetracked with the Ukraine thing.
Oh, so yeah, people were asking about that and kind of how the film did afterwards, what the director made, what else the director made since. And sadly, actually, he hasn't, if I'm not mistaken, he only made one more film.
Yeah, and he died...
And he died recently.
Yeah, 4 or 5 years ago, quite young. Like, I think he was, 54 or 55, somewhere in there.
So he's definitely kind of a director of one film, but what an amazing film to be remembered by.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Because normally, if it's a first watch for a guest, I'd say, would you recommend this to other people? But, I mean, clearly you would. You chose it as a Kino Vino feature. But, thank you very much for coming along. And, yeah, it's been a really interesting discussion. And, obviously, great to talk about this film with somebody who grew up in Russia and has a bit more of a, like, insight to into things that I might not have spotted as somebody who didn't grow up there. Yeah.
It was lovely, thanks.
Great. So before we wrap up then, obviously there's Salt and Time available in all good bookshops, I'm guessing.
Yes, and on Amazon as well.
Yep, of course.
Very important.
Would that be available outside of the UK as well?
Yes, the book is actually also available in Australia. And it's coming out in Canada and the United States in September, I think.
Oh, okay. Oh, great. But apart from Salt and Time, where would we find you on the internet?
So I've got a website, kinovino.org, which got all the information about my supper clubs. And I do private events as well. And then I'm quite obsessed with Instagram, so...
Yes, as you mentioned.
On Instagram, I am Borscht and No Tears, which is a bit of a silly name, but I love it.
And that's Borscht spelt B-O-R-S-C-H, right? Yes.
Yes.
No T. Yes, I know some... I don't know why a T gets inserted there somewhere.
I don't understand where.
No sense.
Maybe it's a Yiddish spelling?
Maybe. I'd have to look that up.
But yeah, if you transliterate Borscht, there's no T anywhere.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's me online.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, I would definitely encourage people to check those out, although probably check it out on a full stomach, otherwise you're just, going to be giving yourself extreme hunger pangs.
Or if you're close to the kitchen and cook straight away.
Yes.
But yeah, if you're stuck on a train and a hunger somewhere, then maybe not.
Bookmark it and come back to it later. Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, thank you again so much, Alyssa, for coming along.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
It's been a great, fun discussion, albeit not about the cheeriest film, but certainly one that's well worth people checking out.
Oh, it's definitely worth mentioning and discussing, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thanks.
And до свидания, folks.
До свидания.
Then, folks, that is the episode. If you'd like to get in touch, there's a couple of different ways you can do that. So there's Twitter, we're at RusFilesU, that's RusFiles with the letter U at the end. You can email at RusFilesUnite@gmail.com. And there's also a Facebook group that you can join. if you could spare a few minutes to rate the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you get this, that would help the podcast and I would massively, massively appreciate it. Speaking of where you get your podcasts, Russophiles Unite is part of the Radio Public Paid Listens program. So that means if you listen to this show on Radio Public, I actually get paid for it. Also, I have just started a Ko-fi page for Russophiles Unite where you can support the show financially on a one-off basis. So that is at www.ko-fi.com/Russophiles Unite. If you're able to support the show that way, that would be amazing. If not, please consider sharing the show via social media and recommending it to anyone you think would be interested. Thanks again for listening, and bye for now.